Madam, we've received a complaint. Mr. Clutterbuck has...
Is that his name?
No, it is indeed. He...
Unfortunate, but brave.
If I could proceed, Mr. Clutterbuck has reported to the town council and stated to the village voice that he witnessed you, Miranda Merrick, dancing.
What? The village council may be close-minded, archaic pea brains, but as far as I know, they've not passed a law prohibiting one's own right of personal private expression by dancing.
If you would let me finish, Mr. Clutterbuck witnessed you, Miranda Merrick, wantonly dancing in the cemetery!
Ah, well, this is a clutterbuck.
It is indeed, madam.
Welcome to the Midnight Library, everyone. Oh, it is so wonderful to have you visit for tonight's reading. Won't you please come into the reading room? And please help yourself to tonight's light refreshments on the hospitality tray. Hmm? What's that, dearie? What is it? Bankers can't be choosers, puppet. If we're generous enough to hand out rarefied treats, I suggest you eat first and hope to live to ask questions later. You're welcome. Honestly. There we are. There is a prime spot near my chair. If anyone would like to cuddle with a wolf pup, if you have thick skin... I am your hallowed host, Miranda Merrick. Tonight's topic is one I'm willing to wager each of us has a fondness for, or equally as precious, a horrible memory of, dancing. I know I've seen, I must have heard somewhere that many of you are very fine and expressive dancers. You're always having lively weddings, evening gatherings, and street parties here in the village. The variety of national cultural dances alone held here is staggering, pun not intended. And it's such a wonderful way to meet people and to get an immediate understanding of their artistic flair, grace, and coordination, if they have any. I don't mind bragging to you that all of the beings here in the Midnight Library are excellent dancers, even the ones that slither and have no legs, and even those who no longer have bodies. We're given to having our own calendar of clandestine dances throughout the year, as well as spontaneous impromptu dances thrown at the drop of a hat or guest. Some of you, and you know who you are sometimes privileged enough to be in attendance at these private dances and have partaken of the ritualistic steps and sacred ceremonies. And if you want to stay on the exclusive invitation list, I gently remind you of your sworn oaths of silence and strict confidentiality. Right, my lovelies? Right. Tonight, we're going to bring into the spotlight an ancient and revered dance, and everyone here has an open invitation to it. No one will be left out, as its host has the most gracious and non-discriminatory nature. And not one of you has the right of refusal, no matter how busy you are or how many left feet you have. You are booked for this appearance. You are the star performer. You will be there center stage. But not to worry. You won't have to dance alone, you'll have a partner. There will always be a vacant spot on your dance card reserved for the dance macabre. Also referred to as the Dance of Death, the Danse Macabre is a fanciful and foreboding depiction of everyone's steps leading up to their grave, the scene of which is rich in dreary character like no other. I simply cannot wait to describe its collection of incarnations for you, dear guests. The Dismal Dance is believed to have made its first public appearance in a location where you and I first met not all that long ago, the Paris Cemetery of the Holy Innocents, where I then coaxed you below ground to the Paris Catacombs. It was all so romantic. In 1424, one of the first known frescoes displaying the Dance of Death was said to have been painted large and sprawling across the cemetery wall, showing a long procession of living men, all cloaked in their workaday garb, each in the company of a skeletal companion, each present in strict order of their social status within the Parisian community. So, of course, the church and state were represented at the front of the line, and the working-class men were assigned to the rear. In equal measure, though, each man was given a painted title beneath his image. A kind of label was scripted that read, Pope, King, Blacksmith, Farmer, etc. The idea, of course, was to show that, no matter their station in life, high-born or low, each would, one day, be taking these last steps alongside death. I am disheartened to tell you that nothing remains of this undoubtedly riveting artwork. I cannot tell you how sad it is to me that it was destroyed. First and foremost, what is important for you to know is that the Danse Macabre is not just a dance. It's more of a, I was going to say, life philosophy, but it truly is the opposite. It is a death philosophy. It carries with it its own origin and history. It's wonderfully embedded in many cultures and is present in literature, poetry, music, art, and of course, dance. The most beguiling characteristic of it, if you ask me, is death personified. If you will only consider this aspect for just a moment, there's a high probability that you've almost always accepted the nature of death, which is a happening, as being a being. From your earliest years, you've seen the act of dying, the state of being dead, or the known eventuality of the coming of death, represented as a figure dressed up in the human costume of either a skeleton or a robed being bearing a scythe, a sickle, or an empty hourglass. A grim reaper, one poised to cut down the living and escort them to their grave. This makes death more acceptable to you without you even realizing. Death becomes so much more relatable when you believe him to inhabit a nice familiar form, a human form, albeit wrapped in a pitch black cloak or just a walking set of dry bones. He's just one of us. Well, one of you. He's a kindly gent with a job to do. He's your made-of-bone chaperone. Oh, and he's always smiling. Well then, he must be a friend. And apparently, there's talk of dancing. It's nothing to be frightened of. It's all going to be fine and even fun. Sure, let's go with that. The Dance Macabre is thought to have been handed down in the telling and retelling of stories and poems, then later manifested as written versions of these long-told tales. Initially, these were fables with a fact-of-life message for common, everyday people to help them cope with the idea of accepting their fate. The stories used colorful, important figures as their lead characters to subtly engross the listener into taking a keen interest. They involved royalty and politicians, popes and knights, all encountering death. And who wouldn't want to hear about that? A story about a corrupt, greedy king who took your family's farmland just to have a place to raise his pet poodles, coming face to face with death, and learning he's about to lose? Oh yes, let's hear about that. One might imagine the setting, say, medieval times. The pompous, portly king traveling the lush countryside in his luxurious horse-drawn coach is delayed on the road by a plain and simple wagon. He quickly becomes annoyed, sending his driver to order the obstructing carriage to be removed from the road. His loyal coachman quickly obeys, but doesn't return to the royal coach in a moment as the king expects. The bloated king grows impatient, having waited for as many as perhaps 5 whole minutes before boiling over with anger, forcing his flushed red noble noggin out the fine-draped window, he shouts at the top of his lung, "If that pauper sled is not removed from the road this instant, I shall personally behead its useless stinking driver." He plops down in a huff and waits, but nothing happens. He wrenches open the carriage door to glare at whoever he can. His own driver isn't even visible, and the lone carriage sits perfectly still, blocking the narrow road. Its team of dull black workhorses appear to neither breathe nor blink. The birds have hushed, and even the wind in the leaves of the trees. And every living thing, for as far as the king can see, is fixed motionless in its place. Upon seeing this, His Royal Highness thinks, "Ah, the world stops in reverence of my presence. It is sad I have to kill a peasant myself on such a fine day." He hotly exits the cab, awkwardly managing his rotundness to land on his feet that now carry him in an enraged march to the front of the modest coach.
"Driver, dismount!" he bellows.
He draws in a quick breath of shock upon seeing the man, dressed in clean but threadbare funeral vestments, the thinnest man he's ever seen, silently descends from the coachman's seat and alights on the ground. He stands squarely in front of the bulging monarch, his gaunt frame equal only in height to that of the king. His sunken, dingy eyes stare unblinking at the king. Transfixed by the withered man, the monarch can only mumble,
"I order you to move this coach. No mere man shall impede you. Me, your majesty. No mere man shall impede me, your majestic king."
The hollow-cheeked man slowly opens his dry mouth to quietly proclaim, "I am no mere man." As he speaks, his sallow skin appears to thin and draw down tight against his showing bones. I am Death. Today, you will obey me. The horrified king can only think to flee from this obstructing ghoul. He steps to the left of the wasting man, who precisely mirrors his motion. The king flanks to the right in lockstep with the now nearly skeletal man before him. Death smiles with what's left of his papery lips. For a time, the two beings, one living and one dead, face one another as perfectly paired dance partners are seen to do.
I'm the ruler, and you must let me pass, says the bewildered king.
I am your ruler, and I will help you pass, says Death as he graciously offers the king his fleshless hand. This is how many of the first Dance Macabre stories are set. Some feature the more powerful members of society being put in their place by several in a cast of dead ushers. The mighty are frankly told that their power, wealth, or even piety is no longer worth anything. They cannot command, purchase, or pray their way out of dying. There is no escape. They are then told to step right this way. Tonight's reading at the Midnight Library is proudly brought to you by Grimm's Grocers. You've chosen to visit, you've picked out your seat, we've given you tea and something to eat. These cookies you munch as you take in my story, you may have a hunch they themselves are quite gory. They're from Grimm's, of course, and no ordinary scones. This treat tour de force made of mangled up bones. Grimm's reaped and then dried, and then crushed and rolled fine. Some careless being who died, on their bones you now dine. Waste not, want not, we say, so fill up your belly. A skeleton cookie buffet, made with marrow bone jelly. Grimm's Ossi de Morti cookies can be found in their back room. Just knock three times on the black door and say Mr. Darling sent you. Artists in these early times, it should be pointed out, had a surreptitious kind of magnificent power to send this message that common people did not. You may recall, if you happen to attend our reading on the philosophy of Memento Mori, the practice of staying aware that death is omnipresent and indiscriminate, and can be oh so swift. Well, the Danse Macabre is aligned with and akin to Memento Mori in its message. And the artists who were commissioned in these times had to be well aware that how they ultimately depicted the upper crust of society was fairly much up to them. After all, if there was going to be a grand mural exhibited for everyone in the city to see, well, of course, the higher-ups were going to be present, or perhaps even featured. What resulted were often members of the current kingdom or even the pope and bishops being prominently portrayed, but kneeling before death, pleading with him, having their regal gowns and holy headdresses plucked from their privileged heads by death. I believe there's a book here in the Midnight Library that contains a delightful Danse Macabre scene of an unnamed king arrogantly gliding by with his nose in the air, ignoring the poor and suffering of his people, his majestic bejeweled robe carelessly dragging on the ground behind him, with death just about to step down on it and snatch him backwards. Memento Mori. Remember, you must die. Indeed. It is my hope, dear guests, that you will treat yourself to viewing the Danse Macabre's various artistic renditions as a collection, so you can see them comparatively. The effect is gloriously chilling. Let me describe just a few for you now. Large rings of smartly dressed royalty in colorful waistcoats and flowing gowns are assembled on bright green stately grounds. Interspersed among them are animated skeletons, gleefully leading the dancers to their graves. It's thought that many of these portrayals were born out of the time of the Great Plague, the Black Death, a time when entire villages were emptied of their living. In these settings, Death dances wearing clean white robes as he embraces a pox-riddled dying man. At times, we seem to have arrived to view the scene just after the dance has finished. Here we are treated to seeing Death as a kind of hero who has gallantly caught his partner in his bony arms just as they've collapsed and died. See? Chivalry isn't never mind. Some scenes, although they may at first seem grimly ordinary, come complete with wince-inducing details. A procession of dignified, healthy members of society in noble garments have locked arms with a band of conservatively flesh-covered skeletons. It only takes a moment more to notice that all of the dead have had their abdomens split wide open to reveal their bare spines inside, or to let fall out their now useless intestines, which flies are feasting on. The most disturbing thing here may be how joyous everyone looks. By the 1500s, the idea of Death as a humanized character was becoming more and more popular. Artists, printmakers, woodcarvers, and authors began creating their own personal works featuring this theme, which were sometimes made available for sale to the public. We even have record of a series of woodcuttings that were later published in book form, and 500 years later, we even know the artist's name. He was Hans Holbein, and his works depicting the Danse Macabre are exceptional, to say the least. His painstakingly detailed carvings begin, well, at the beginning. The fine line art shows Death paying a visit to Adam and Eve. He kindly plays a tune on a lyre-type instrument as the sinning pair are about to be struck down from the low clouds bearing down upon their cursed heads by the mighty sword of the Angel of Death. In print upon print, Holbein vividly portrays Death as a being in the company of the living, often dancing, assisting, and escorting them to their graves. At the time of Holbein's own death in 1543, the compilation of his woodcuts in book form had become so famously popular. The book was often stolen and even illegally copied and sold, so great was the demand for it. Rumors that we have a signed copy here might be, true. We have so many books, as you can see. I recall seeing a wonderful woodcut, likely from the same time period. It features some peasant farmers toiling away, carefully tending to their precious new shoots sprouting from the soil of their modest field. And a troop of bizarrely drawn skeletons have just encircled them and begun dancing and trouncing under their bony feet the life-giving young plants the men are so concerned with. One skeleton grins as he playfully takes a pitchfork away from one of the working men, while another tries to persuade the other farmer to halt his work and dance with him instead. My favorite from this scene is a lone, cheery skeleton who appears to have made a makeshift shovel out of leg bones and a pelvis. With this, he's digging a good-sized grave as the living look on and the dead dance about. I just realized. This gives a whole new meaning to the word shindig. Sorry. Tonight's reading at the Midnight Library is also brought to you by the Broom and Fang Pub. Sometimes at the Broom and Fang, there's more than drinks and grub. Sometimes there's a secret dance inside our secret pub. If you're on the guest list, you'll receive an invitation to witness all the weirdness of this eerie celebration. See your Ms. Merrick twirl in trance, rise off the floor and hover. See her cast a wicked glance from which you won't recover. Watch Darling change into a wolf and dance on his 4 feet. See him eat a guest or two and never miss a beat. There on a date, Father Philbrook and our little Irma, the demon and the pastor. If they decide to procreate, there'll be a baby disaster. Familiars scratch and shout their names and lift up off the ground. Devils jump forth from the flames and spirits prance around. The dance goes long into the night, there's magic, mayhem, and lust. And just before the sun comes up, someone bites the dust. Death himself is often there, and the dance becomes a rave. Be his partner if you dare, and end up in your grave. Our guest list is the best list, so those of you in the know, check your mailbox at midnight for your invitation to the Broom and Fang All Ghouls Dance. See you there! Now, dear guests, not wanting to be lax in my duties of entertaining you, I believe that no reading on the Danse Macabre would be well-rounded without the mention of the music that has been especially written to keenly express and capture the lovely doom of this subject. My lament is that there are literally hundreds of the cadaverous compositions that I would only be too pleased to expound on and perhaps even play old records for you on our charming antique Victrola. Why, we could have our own little concert of musical samplings of these gloomy tunes well into the night. But as some of you may know, we in the library are still on nighttime savings time, and this would disrupt our practice of being at rest before sunrise. This being said, I believe it would be a smart assumption to make that versions of the Dance of Death were performed with accompanying music during the earliest times by people with, let's be kind, a great deal of enthusiasm, but perhaps no real musical aptitude or talent. So, of course, there exists no record of these arrangements, thankfully. I imagine these were little more than, frightfully costumed players in spirited ghoulish gear and makeup, backed by individuals or small groups with wooden whistles and pots and pan drums, which in itself does have about it a primal kind of appeal for sure. But the first tune written for the Dismal Dance is born out of the same country, that gifted us with a depiction of death as a dancing fellow in the first place. France. Ah, so many of life's superior endowments come from this cherished land. Not that I'm biased, but I do have a French-born grandmother. In 1872, The Strange Strains began as an art song or kind of rhythmic tonal poem, which was intended to be spoken but following a melody. This tune, oddly enough, was dreamed up by a man of many talents, Henri Cazalès, who was a physician as well as a published author and poet. The most delightful thing about him? Like so many of us here, he was drawn to darkness. He found beauty in the grim and haunting atmosphere of the end of life. So much so that he may have been collecting pictures and artwork of the dead. Well, everyone needs a hobby, right? So it was his Halloween-themed poem, all about promenading skeletons and death personified, playing a repetitious sway-inducing tune on his violin, that just 2 years later caused composer Camille Saint-Saëns to write the now world-famous Danse Macabre Opus 40. Completely revamped and arranged for a full orchestra, the masterful piece was not well received at first. The entrancing rhythmic way of the melody was thought to be too dreary and to cause the listening audience to be angst-ridden and filled with feelings of dread. I'm willing to wager that to all of us here, we feel this was rather the point of the piece. It was then, and it is now. The Danse Macabre, Opus Number 40, is one of the most popular and most beloved eerie masterpieces of dramatic orchestral scores in existence. It has been featured countless times in minor and major motion pictures, stage plays, dance and poetry recitals, television productions, background for audiobooks, horror soundtracks, Mickey Mouse cartoons, and most importantly, as a Halloween anthem. And it is in the air around us at this very moment. I happen to think it's divine. I rather like the idea of the coincidence of having it be the death knell of our happy evening together. I'm cheery like that. Thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight in the Midnight Library Reading Room. Oh, and maybe we'll see some of you in the Broom and Fang soon. Those of you who know what you know, well, you know. Our Mr. Darling will see you safely to the door. After that, you're on your own. Good night, everyone. Good night, my dear guests.
Excellent reading tonight, madam. Shall we return the Clutterbuck complaint?
I suppose.
The village voice, madam, in the interest of fairness, asks if you would be good enough to explain your actions honestly. And they've even inserted a little framed text to the parlance. Honesty is the best policy.
Well, then by default, that makes dishonesty the second best policy.
What's your point?
My point is, second best is more than good enough for this clutterbuck. Respond that I was dancing in the cemetery on my childhood ballet teacher's grave to show him how much I've improved.
Excellent. I'll pop it in the post.
The Midnight Library is proudly brought to you by everyone at Astonishing Legends. Our excellent sound design is by Chris and Jason at Sounds Like an Earful. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I would love to hear from you personally. Please join our Patreon at patreon.com/midnightlibrary. And our wonderful but warped merch is available from Redbubble on redbubble.com/people/midnightlibrary.